Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program is broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugalpul peoples, the Yugambeh, Munundjali, Kombamiri, Noonuccal, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. My guest today is the CEO of the Australian Indigenous Communications Association, known as ACCA, based down in Canberra, the Secretariat, Conan Fulton. Conan, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm very well, Tiger. Very well. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on board, recovering after your big national gathering, the ACCA AGM.
That's right. Yes, plenty of planning. It's like a pregnancy, I was saying to a few people. By the end of it, mate, you just want that baby to come along and get out. So it was a great time, mate. It was a good couple of days.
It certainly was. First up, tell us your mob, your country.
I'm a Palawa man from Tasmania. I grew up down in the Central Highlands and up Derwent Valley there in Tasmania. My mum is from that area, Cheryl Fulton, and I grew up down there. And then my father's country down there is from the Tasman Peninsula.
All right. Did you go to school over there in Tassie? Your younger years, early years over there?
I did. I grew up in Tassie. I spent my years until about 17 down there in Tassie. I grew up in the Derwent Valley. A lot of my high school years and stuff, I moved down to the big smoke of Hobart. But we had a property up about 40 acres out there in the Derwent Valley, and I grew up. Also spent a few years living in a place called the Salmon Ponds. My father worked in fisheries. And we lived at a place called the Salmon Ponds there. So it's always been around water, fresh water there. We had a river there and the property. We had a creek and stuff. And then moved down to the big smoke of Hobart before at the age of 17 and moved away working for the ABC. I was working as a producer and presenter for ABC Radio.
How long did you do with the ABC?
I was there for about three years or so. I was there. I moved around from Hobart in Radio Metro down there in Hobart and up to Launceston. Then came over to my first trip over to Canberra, and the first big trip off the little island to the mainland. Moved up here to Canberra. Worked at Triple Six in Canberra, and then ended up doing a bit of work up in Sydney, in and around Triple J, and even spent some time in the radio archives up in Ultimo there in Sydney.
Okay. Yeah, having known your mum for some 30 years or so, you've grown up with radio. I imagine you would have been around your mum when she was doing radio in the early years.
Exactly. I spent a lot of time there in the studio with her when she was doing the Way Radio back in the 80s. As a young fellow, I was in there in the second studio, spinning records in that second studio. Mm. I got the bug early for radio, and I think in a love of gadgets and technology. Kids are always into new technology, whatever it is. I mean, for me, a record player was new technology back in the day.
Yeah.
But grew up around that and spent time there, and I'd worked my way up to the point where I'd actually operate the desk for her, where she'd sit there and do the program from the other side. And then, she was also obviously heavily involved in the community and the politics of the day down there in Tassie. So, not uncommon for me to come out from school and go up to the old TAC, Aboriginal Centre there, and paint some placards for the march on the weekend and, used to play table tennis there quite regularly against Uncle Mick Mansell after school. So it's a pretty interesting environment to grow up in there. Got a pretty fast education in the politics of the day.
Good one. What was it like? Well, first of all, Way Radio. Now, that's one of the oldest, if not the first, that's been documented for radio broadcast, First Nations programming on air.
That's right.
That's correct?
That's right. It was. It was one of, if not the first, and I think it ended up being the longest running program. I know that I had a stint after my time in the ABC. I moved back to Tassie from Sydney, and was doing the show back then in the 90s. I mean, that show ran for a number of years. Unfortunately, is not going at the moment. We'll be on to that. We'll rectify that problem shortly, I'm sure. But it was one of the very early shows. It was funny, actually. There was the three Cheryls from Tasmania that were involved in radio in those days. Yeah, I had Cheryl Fulton, you had Cheryl Brown, and you had Cheryl Schramm. Mm. And the three of them were involved, and I think Cheryl Schramm went on to work at ABC Radio in Sydney and Jarak, the Indigenous unit there.
There was a
strong involvement in radio back in the 80s there from Tassie.
Well, Cheryl Schramm was the first CEO of our first national media organisation, which was NABA, the National Aboriginal Islander Broadcast Association. And now you're the CEO of the current one. So you Tasmanians have got something about keeping things moving and seeing that things continue on.
That's right. I mean, and I really believe in those signs. You see those things come around again. If they cross your path again, I reckon they're crossing your path for a reason. The fortunate opportunity I have here to be back involved in the sector. Moving out of working in ABC happened purely because there was the first APG conference meeting that was held down here in Canberra at Bumalala Oval, and I had a mob from Tassie were here. I came down, got homesick, got the fire in the belly again for working for community. Jumped on the plane and went home to Tassie and left my car and my apartment and everything there in Sydney and went back to Tassie and started working in. I did some work in the youth program there for the legal service, for the health service. I had a stint down there managing a substance abuse centre they had up there on the east coast of Tassie. Did some work in the land council on repatriation of remains of our ancestors from cultural institutions across the world. So I had an involvement in all kinds of bits and pieces there back in the community, and really got the fire in the belly going again back for doing some work for the mob. Before that led back into government, and I came up to Canberra again to working out in a juvenile justice sort of focused program. So that got me back up here to Canberra again.
What was it like growing up, going to school, your years, early days there, growing up in Tasmania as a First Nations person with that history and with that still a lot of people think and say, oh, Tasmania, no black fellas here, they shot them all out and stuff. What was it like? Can you recall at all? Was it a bit difficult or...
Yeah, it was. It was, I had such a strong and proud, family history and connection and connection back to our country. And at the same time, yeah, growing up and, you've the stories there and the imagery of the noble savages and the great diorama down there in the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery, of the blackfella standing on one leg on the spear. And, that's the culture frozen in time image that everybody has of First Nation mobs, especially down in Tassie. And I mean, redneck politics in Tassie is nothing new. I mean, the government at times has come out and, blatantly almost said that there's no blackfellas in Tasmania. I mean, growing up, the curriculum I was being taught in school and what I was being taught at home and seeing in my community were at odds, with each other. I remember one day clearly being out in the back of the school there up near the netball courts, and some kids had put out some glass on the ground of the netball court and saying, well, you say you're a blackfella, blackfellas have got tough feet, so you must be able to walk over this glass, so it was like a walking over the fire or the coals or something like that. It was like, because apparently, blackfellas must have tough feet, she was a funny old time, but I mean, having the the opposite issue of a lot of people trying to, you know, justify, you know, your blackness. It's like people go, you know, saying, you know, you're not black, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, our mob are strong down there, and I've always been, you know, in and around the mix with the, you know, the hardline politics. So, look, you know, I had plenty of people to, you know, to set me straight and make sure I knew about our culture and our mob.
You're very fortunate in that regard. It was a great opportunity for you.
It really was. It really was. I mean, you know, being able to be around some of the people that in those days involved in the struggle, and you know, a lot of people today, you know, could do well to remember those that have come before and fought those battles. So we're fortunate enough to, you know, to have the opportunities, us younger generation that we have now. You know, only exist because of the battles that were fought many years ago.
Yes, by many, many people. Yeah. You've joined this organisation, ACRE, only a little over three months ago as a CEO. How important is it for First Nations people to be in control, to be running their own media, be it radio, TV like NITV? Well, they're not quite running it, but there's a bit of an attempt to run it, I suppose, under the guise of SBS. But we've got Tracker Magazine and Koori Mail and National Indigenous Times. There may well be other print media as well. But how important is it, do you think, not only for First Nations people, but for the country generally?
It's not just important, it's essential. I mean, blackfellas have to be in control of their own media, and from a number of perspectives. I mean, we have to ensure that our mob are informed of what's going on, and that we do that in a way that's appropriate for them, and whether that's taking in considerations of language or the context in which the message is being told. I mean, we need to make sure that we're getting the messages that are important out to our people. I mean, I've been using the phrase here that it's important for the black voices to be heard through the white noise. Everybody's bombarded every day with so much media, social media, you know, mainstream media. You know, you can't get away from messaging and imagery at the moment. It's important for us to take control of that and ensure that the messages that need to be heard by our mob are being heard by our mob. But, I mean, also, I mean, the role that our sector and that our Indigenous media networks have also go far beyond just being the end of the pipeline for government messaging and as well. I mean, we have a huge opportunity here to develop our communities, develop our nation through the use of these networks. Many of our organisations are already doing work that's outside, you know, the remit of just running a radio or, you know, or a television station. You know, the community development role that they play. I mean, some of the organisations that are doing everything from early childhood sort of development. They're doing, you know, running all kinds of programs and activities, and they become a real community hub that's just based around, you know, the activity of media. So it's important important that as a sector, you know, we're acknowledged as a professional sector. We're not just, you know, a tag on or an added on to the community broadcasting sector that Indigenous broadcasting is. It's in its own right a professional sector. I mean, I've said this before, we've survived through, you know, Labor governments, Liberal governments, coalition governments, governments with ATSIC, without ATSIC. This sector has survived and continued to be the voice of our people, and we will do in the future.
Yeah. You recently, I suppose, disclose that I was the chairperson of ACRE for the last 2 years and secretary for a year or two before that. And term was up and stood down. We have some new members on the board, a new chair, Trevor Tim from Bumabibra Media, and congratulations to Trevor on that election. But you've attended last month the remote. We got a very diverse sector, and you attended the remote festival, the IRCA, the Indigenous Remote Communications Association Festival, where all the bush mob get together, and that was out at Hermansburg, Warren H. Williams country. Well, my question is, do the bush mob, do them remote mob, have a different different agendas or different ways of different priorities, different ways of doing things insofar as media? What are your thoughts?
I think there definitely are differences. I think one of the major differences, obviously, is that urban mob do have choice in terms of other media outlets, whereas you know you've got far greater limits on where you can actually get your messaging from, where you can get your news, where you can get your information from out in the remote sector. Obviously, in areas, traditional areas where we still English is a second, third, fourth language, then you've got those issues to contend with as well, and you need those services to be broadcasting in language. So you've got other considerations there. The structure of the sector with the sort of hubs and spokes models they have with the Remos and the Ribs to allow local content to get on air is a great concept. We need to make sure that it's always happening in practice, and we need to be able to, I think, make sure that the resourcing is there so that those local stations have the ability to get local content produced and actually up on air. I think the idea that we had, like with NITV, being an opportunity for people, from the community to get their stories shown to a national audience, is a great aspiration. I don't think the reality of that is quite there yet, and especially for the remote mob. And I can understand that with them losing their own local broadcasting, television broadcasting services, that they can feel that they might not have got the best end of the deal in that regard. But also that real community development opportunities that takes on another whole role and aspect out. I think in the remote areas, some of these organisations really do have the potential to be hubs of activity and actually provide opportunities in terms of health and education outcomes. Whereas I think maybe in some of the urban areas, in the big cities, that there's other organisations that are taking on those roles. So I think that in the remote sector, the organisations can take on a far broader role than they currently do. And I mean, this is one of the things that we're going to be speaking to government about, is that you don't need to be reinventing liaison offices and outposted positions and people out in communities and trying to, set them up to establish connections with communities. It's like these community organisations out there, we've got radio and television stations that it's their business to communicate with their mob. They know how to talk to their people. It's about time that we made better use of those. And got them involved in a broader range of activities, I believe.
Mm. The Remos and Ribs you refer to, Ribs is Remote Indigenous Broadcasting Service, was formerly BRACS, Broadcasting for Remote Aboriginal Communities Service.
Right.
The Remos are the remote the coordinating groups or coordinating bodies for a cluster of Ribs, and Remos are the Remote Indigenous Media Organisations. Funding-wise, we're seeing in the last, I think, since the Howard government maybe, we're seeing a big shift in funding where there is a higher amount, bigger money, or money being spent in remote areas than on in for First Nations issues and peoples, as opposed to the city. Do you think that there's more money available out there just because of that, as opposed to the urban situation?
I think so. I think the perception from government at times is that that all these issues are always going to be greater or more dire in remote communities, and in some instances that's the case, and in other instances it's not the case. But I think as well it's easier where they have identified communities and smaller areas to target for their pilot programs, which unfortunately is, you know, a bane of working with government, that you'll have seed funding for programs that will exist for a year or a couple of years, or if you're lucky, and then, you know, just long enough for you to actually find out that something works, and then that program disappears. But I think that is the case, that they, you know, are concentrating a lot on remote communities because of you know, the lack of access to a lot of services. I mean, I have a history as well in working in Indigenous policy around health and education, and you know, geographically, obviously, access to those services is limited out in those communities. So I think it's in, you know, it's important, and this is, you know, coming from, you know, a previous, you know, background in government policy. You know, a lot of people do tend to forget about the large urban population, but in specific instances, you know, they need to concentrate more on urban, and for other policy areas, they do need to, I think, concentrate more on the remote communities.
Mm, yeah. My guest is Conan Fulton, CEO for the Australian Indigenous Communications Association, a small secretariat. I think you got, what, 4 staff there, Conan?
That's it,
yeah.
Yep.
Small secretariat, but a big job, a big responsibility, a lot of work to be done, which also incorporates trying to look for more funding, because we've been pretty well neglected for a long, long time, not just the last few budgets, but for probably 15 consecutive budgets or like, it's ridiculous how First Nations media has been neglected. You got any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, the entire model, I think, too, the Indigenous Broadcasting Program and the model is still stuck back in the BRACS days, when the model was first set up. I don't think the government policy has changed, and they still see it as you know, that sort of program that was set up then, and we just leave it alone and leave the funding at the same, and don't really worry about it too much. Whereas, like we said, they're missing the opportunity that's there for them to use, like, a you know, an amazingly vibrant and professional network of communications individuals that are out there. And the funding levels at the moment are just not adequate, and that's obviously one of the priorities for ACRES and organisations that she's trying to address.
A good example of this lack of recognition, lack of valuing, is the Close the Gap strategy. We often hear Close the Gap, and there's, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars for closing the gap. And I think there's a very small amount of it, a minute amount of that sort of money goes into First Nations media. And I would expect that First Nations media would be the first port of call for these sorts of things. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly right. This is the issue that we're trying to get across here, is I think that for too long, either government departments naive as to the actual nature of the sector and how broad the network actually is. I don't think there's many people out there in the government sector that actually know, you know, over 130 or so in Indigenous media outlets, you know, across the country, and would have no idea that they had local radio and television broadcasting capability in some of these communities, and it's viewed as too often as just, okay, well, that's, you know, the end of the line for our mainstream messaging. You know, we'll create some sort of national generic advertising campaign, and we'll send it out the pipeline, and that's all the sector is there for, which isn't doing, you know, justice to anybody. And the fact that the funding levels haven't changed for a number of years is just ridiculous. The digital convergence, the fact that that all the different media streams are coming together, the fact that the content that is being developed, a radio station is now streaming on the internet, a radio station is now producing video content, is doing so much more. the output from the sector has increased exponentially, and the funding has remained the same. So you know, this is something that needs to be addressed, and you know, something that we'll be taking up with the new advisory group. We've already put it on the agenda with Mr. Mundine, and we'll be looking to take that up with the government as soon as possible, and educate, I think, the government as to, as I said, the professional sector that's out there, and it's a little bit of help us help you. We're out there. We've got the networks. You don't need to take time to train us up to teach us how to talk to blackfellas. Mm. That's our business. That's what we do. Make use of this network that's out there already, and the fact that we should be going to these regional media organisations when you're developing advertising and communication strategies for government programs. We don't need to just be sending out generic materials, from one source, that make use of those people and professionals that are out there.
And you mentioned earlier in the discussion that we are an essential service, essential in our own communities for First Nations people, but essential for the country, essential for the dominant culture, settler society, to hear directly from First Nations people, where we're articulating our history, our experiences, our identity, all of this. So it's not just a black thing.
No, that's right. That's right. And I mean, look, you know, some people may argue, look, black fellas have been educating white fellas, you know, for a couple of hundred years, as to our culture, and whether we need to be doing that anymore. It's whether they need to educate themselves. But it's like, that's still the role that the sector can do. It's not only continuing our language, our culture, and giving opportunity for stories to be told and heard by other Indigenous people, but as you say, by the wider community as well, so that they understand how vibrant our culture and how alive our culture, and like I said, in terms of languages and stories, whether it's to get those stories and messages out there to be heard by not only their own community, but also the broader community.
I've often said that government doesn't value us, and the dominant culture doesn't really value us. We're always going cap in hand like beggars, just for survival, for the funding and stuff. But that needn't be the case. When we look at, like, closing the gap, the big anti-smoking campaign that Tom Kelmer ran, tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, a station like this one here, 98.9 FM, I think we got $1,500, a spend of $1,500 out of that. This is an example of where there is funding and it could be fee-for-service rather than us going in as beggars. Do you see an opportunity there? I mean, and I've only just given two examples, closing the gap strategies, the anti-smoking campaign for First Nations people. There is an opportunity here, is there not?
There is, and it's not just an opportunity. It's best case. It's best practice to do it that way. I mean, the Stevens Review made it very clear that the messaging and programming that's put on Indigenous community radio, it should be paid messaging. It's not there shouldn't be an onus there on we fund the service, you take our messages. It should be a fee for service basis. I mean, you mentioned a couple of those campaigns. I mean, we used the National Ear Health campaign as a model of good practice at our national conference. Because it went locally and developed content and paid for content to be developed at a local regional level. So ensuring that was appropriate, whether it be in language, whether it be that it's just local voices and local people. People engage with that kind of messaging far greater. So, you know, it's not just good practice to do it that way. It works. It's the best way to get that messaging out. The fact that a lot of these messages are being created with massive budgets and then rolled out generically is not a model that we should be pursuing.
Most certainly. And when you look at the language, and you've already mentioned that there's places where these radio stations are operating, First Nations media operate, where English is a second, third, fourth language. So the stations can also put these messages out in local language.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, that obviously is going to engage the audience and the listener far greater than something that's coming to them in their second or third language. And the fact that it's not just that it works more effectively. This should be the way that the government operates. I mean, the fact that the government would consider putting out messaging in other languages, non-Indigenous languages, to get the message out to the multicultural areas of Australian society, they'd consider that. Yet they seem to forget about First Nations, Mom. They forget about the first Australian sitting here with our languages. Yet they'll fund any number of activities to get messaging out in other language other than in first Australian language.
Yes. Now, with the big national gathering, I imagine you've got some work to do. I mean, there'd be some issues put up, some things to pursue. What came out of it for the Secretariat? What is it that you see you need to work on?
There's a number of large pieces of work. One of the major pieces is the National Indigenous Media Policy. Is continuing the work that's been started there and by Dot West. That is, I think, our big opportunity to engage with government. I guess the fact that there has never been, as far as I'm aware, any sort of official government policy on Indigenous media or communications is ridiculous. So this is our opportunity. Again, at the moment, the only sort of national level policy around Indigenous affairs really is the Closing a Gap, going through the COAG agenda. So this is our opportunity to get in there with this new government and say, look, this is what this sector is about. This is what this sector can do, not only for government. This is what the sector can do for our mob. Also, there's a number of internal things for ACA to work on as well. We're going to be looking at our own strategic and operational plan, which was started off by a session that we had there at the forum, giving the entire membership the opportunity to have input into an operational plan. I think in terms of having an open and transparent governance and having an organisation that can represent the sector, we need to give the membership and the sector the opportunity to have input into that. That's an essential part of the way that I would like to see the organisation running. So we've obviously got work to follow up on that. Also going to be continuing again the work that we've started with the National Learning and Development Strategy. This is a way of ensuring that we can increase the pool of skilled First Nations mob out there working in the sector and giving them an opportunity if they want to pursue the communications industry as a career choice, that it's not just something you do on a volunteer basis or as an aside, that this is your career. You're an Indigenous broadcaster. You work in communications. So we want to make sure that there's training opportunities as well as employment opportunities. Too often we see training opportunities with no real employment outcomes. We're not interested in training for training's sake. We want to make sure that there are pathways for people so that they can actually, you know, get employment and you know, get the dollars they need to, you know, to provide for their families.
Yeah, that's one of the real concerns I have, where this is an essential service, First Nations media, but the funding isn't there, particularly for the RIBS operators. Mm-hmm. Those guys out in bush communities, remote communities, are not really funded for full-time operations, just a couple of hours a day, and I think that is that's just sad. And they expect one person to be on air or running the radio station on their own all day for little money, and it's really sad, and a bit of work required there. But how hopeful are you of with the new government in place, new federal government, Warren Mundine that's chairing the advisory committee and stuff? Yous have already attempted to get their attention and get them over for a meeting and stuff. How hopeful are you of making some gains, getting some outcomes, positive outcomes?
Look, I have to be hopeful, Tiger. You know, the pulling back together of, you know, all the Indigenous programs into PMNC, sort of, you know, I don't know, a wind back, a pseudo ATIC without the, you know, the regional actual representation. I think there are great opportunities there, because having worked for a number of years in government areas and government policy, I mean, there's people out there that are working towards the same goal, sometimes within the same departments, and have no idea of the direction and that other areas of their own department are going, the fact that they're both trying to work towards the same thing. So I'm hopeful that there will be some streamlining of processes. There will be some pooling of funding, and this is my major concern, is that just because you find two areas that are doing the same thing, that doesn't mean you can spend half the money. That funding stays at existing levels, and that there is just some efficiencies found in terms of the groups that are working on the same issues are working together, you know, working smarter. So I really hope that in that comes the opportunity for us to present the sector as a vehicle by which that they can engage with the Indigenous community, that they can get their messages out, that they can also use the organisations that are in place to deliver services. I talked before about, you know, an increased role for these organisations. And as you were talking about the RIBS, the fact that these services get funded at a level that they can operate continuously, and that they are developed further. I think the hubs and spokes sort of model is a little bit broken at the moment. That we maybe need to move to a hub to hub. But a smaller hub, and we need to resource some of those smaller areas like the RIBS. We need to resource those better so that they can actually also be providing some of the services in terms of training and things like that in their own areas. But this advisory group, it'll be interesting to see how they interact. To be honest, I've only had very limited interaction with them at the moment, and seen some requests to be involved putting submissions into reviews. They're very short time frames. They're very specific. They're talking about consultation will be done on a specific time frame and by, you know, invited guests only. So it's interesting to see how they do interact with the community, and how they take the message forward from the community, where they're inviting the people along that they want to talk to. So we'll have to wait and see. I have to be hopeful, I do think that there are opportunities that will present by a lot of these areas of government coming together. At the moment, look, there's still going to be a major settling down phase. Having, like I said, worked in government and been through MOG changes and stuff before, there's just the logistics of departments moving around and you turning up and your email doesn't work and all these sorts of things. So they're still going through this little bit of a teething process at the moment. I think the government is kind of to a certain degree shut down a little bit here in terms of its outward aspect. We saw that at our own conference with the representative from the old Department of Broadband and Communications, having a very brief discussion, presentation on the sector, basically saying that things at the moment are as they were, but that's about all I can say. So the government isn't saying much at the moment, to be honest.
Yes. No, you've got a bit of work there to do, but like you say, we've got to stay hopeful.
For sure.
We're some of the most hopeful people in this country. Since they first came here, we hoped that they would come to their senses and treat people and country and flora and fauna with some degree of respect. But we're still hopeful that it'll happen. It's just that they seem to be slow learners, But we've got to stay hopeful.
The message will sink in eventually.
Yeah, we've got to stay hopeful. Yeah. Conlon, is there anything that you'd like to say in winding up?
No, yes, I always have something to say, Tiger. look, I'm amazingly, grateful for the opportunity to get back into this sector and work with like I said, what is a professional network of people across the country. And I do think there are big opportunities and big things that are going to come from this sector. There's a lot of amazing work that's going on out there. I think that this sector can lead the way on a number of fronts. So there is good things and good times coming. I think for this sector, and I think as you sort of said before, we've got a few people fighting over buckets of money, and unfortunately that's been the government policy for a number of years. Is have competitive grants rounds, and it keeps the mob fighting amongst themselves and. Yeah, makes them forget a bit about concentrating on the source of the issue, which is the people that are controlling the bucket of money. So I think there's been some positive steps in the short time that I've been here in terms of a sector, more cohesion in the sector, which is what's needed. We need to present a united front to government and a consistent message. That's a big task here for ACRE, is to represent the entire sector effectively and make sure everybody has an opportunity to have their voice heard.
As diverse as that sector is, yes,
exactly,
that's right. Yeah, well, look, mate, thanks for joining us today. Last minute call. Really appreciate you giving us your time, because you've got a bit of work on your hands there. So good luck with it, and we'll talk again, eh?
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tiger.
Right, buddy. Thank you very much. Have a good day.